It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Tonight at Carnegie Mellon University's McConomy Auditorium, the CMU Film Festival is previewing the film 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. It's a documentary that tells the story of a black 17-year-old named Jordan Davis who was fatally gunned down at a Florida gas station by Michael Dunn, a 47-year-old white man who fired the shots during an argument over loud music. Dunn was convicted of first-degree murder in 2014 and sentenced to life in prison. The film looks at details of the shooting, the trial, and its impact on the Davis family and the role bias and stereotypes play in society. I'm joined now in studio by Ron Davis, the father of Jordan Davis, who is in Pittsburgh for tonight's screening and a discussion to follow. Ron Davis, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Great for having me, Paul. Thank you very much.
You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Florida's Stand Your Ground law, which allows a person to defend their own life using force if there is a threat or perceived threat without first attempting to retreat, was at the heart of the argument for the defense in this case. What do you think of Stand Your Ground laws like Pennsylvania's Castle Doctrine, amended to include Stand Your Ground 3 years ago? What role do biases and stereotypes play in society? Again, the number to join our conversation, 412-246-2002. Ron Davis, the first thing that I want to ask you about, what I really wonder about, is how you deal with the loss of your son in a crime like this. How do you get through each day?
Well, you know, initially when any mother or father or sister or brother gets that call that their loved ones have been killed, especially for something that doesn't really make any sense to you, you know, you sit on the couch and you just think of all the times from the time the person was small, you know, the fun times with the family members, you know, going to picnics, going to church, going to events, and all that is dashed away from you. You know, their life is so important, not only to you and your family, but to the community and to maybe your church. And so initially, you have to find your voice. You know, many families out there, take them a very, very long time to find their voice. But initially, me and Jordan's mother, we found our voice very quickly. And we did that because we didn't want anyone to lead us. We wanted to make sure that we were out front talking about our son and make sure that the world connected with Jordan. So we decided that through Jordan's legacy, we want to make sure that we help other families and also keep other children and other teenagers and other young people from experiencing the same thing that Jordan did, because that could have been avoided had he thought about some of the things that are being said today about how to avoid these kind of tragedies.
Tell us what kind of a young man your son, Jordan, was.
He was a young man that appreciated his friends. He appreciated going to school. He went to Wolfson High School in Jacksonville, and he had an entourage of friends, you know, all nationalities. And me and his mother, we taught him, you know, about race, and you know, my mother and my father, which is his grandparents, they were in World War II, and he was very interested in that. And talk about, you know, the struggles that races have with cultures, about interacting with each other. And most of the time you find out is if you talk to someone of another race that you may get to like them and become friends. A lot of times we are afraid of each other sometimes, and all you have to do is have one engagement with somebody, and you'll see that there's not that much difference between you and someone else, regardless of your nationality. So he was a great kid for that. He absorbed that. He used that in practice with his friendships. He liked to swim. He was a great swimmer, liked to go to the beach in Jacksonville. Me and him did that, and there's special places at the beach that me and him went and that we played in the water. He also liked to play basketball, even though he wasn't that good in it. He was best playing baseball, actually. That was his best sport. He had a girlfriend, and you know, she's a college student now. And I'm going to, you know, I know I reach out to her from time to time, but I know she misses him very much. And he's loved by the community. The city of Jacksonville has reached out to Jordan so much so that they declared that Jordan's birthday, February 16th, is Jordan Davis Day every year in Jacksonville.
What do you think that he might have gone on to do? What did he want to do with his life?
He wanted to join the military. He wanted to either go to the Air Force, which my brother was Air Force career, or either go to the Marines, which his first cousin joined the Marines a few years ago. So that's what he wanted to do. He liked the discipline, and he wanted to, you know, do something and be a part of the country. So that's what he was looking forward to, and he did some work in that respect. So we had so many plans for him, and that's what these people that are just not valuing lives across this country. I know yesterday there were some more lives taken in Kansas. You know, you have to value the lives.
How did you first learn about what happened to your son?
I received a call from a friend of mine, Jordan's best friend, Leland Brunson, who was in the car with him, called his mother frantically on the cell phone and told his mom that Jordan had been shot and that this man was shooting at them also. And I knew all of Jordan's best friends. I mean, his friends that he was going to engage with for a period of time, I always made sure as a parent that I had their parents' numbers, phone numbers, and they had mine. So, and that was very fortunate that I had that situation set up that way, because when Leland called his mother, she called me. And I was at work. I was working part-time at a hotel. And, you know, that drive, Paul, to the hospital is the worst drive in the world, because at that point I didn't know whether Jordan was alive or dead. And so I'm praying all the way to the hospital that he had survived, and maybe it was just a flesh wound. And when you get to the hospital, because of the HIPAA laws, they won't tell you who they have unless they have ID on the person. His wallet had dropped out of his pocket. So it took me an hour to figure it out. And I showed a picture of Jordan from my cell phone. And then the doctor came back. And when he came back with a chaplain and two policemen. And just to hear him say that, "I'm sorry, Mr. Davis, that we could not revive." And that's the only words that I heard from then on. It was just a scream that built up within me that, it had to be so loud that the policemen started wiping their eyes, and one policeman who was like 6'5", 260 pounds, he started crying. So I guess just the hurt that was inside of my body, it just, you know. And I asked to see my son, and they pulled the sheet up over his chest up to his neck. And when I saw my son, he was still my son. You know, I looked at him, and his eye was just a little bit open. And I started talking to him, and I said, "You know, I took care of you for 17 years, Jordan, and now we're going to let God take care of you." I said, "We all try to meet God, and you're going to meet God before me, you know." And they said, "Well, don't touch the body, Mr. Davis, because there's an ongoing investigation." And I ignored them, and I decided to hug my son for the very last time, and I kissed him goodbye, because, you know, when he came into this world by C-section, I was the first one he saw, and I was the first one to kiss my son. So I wanted to be the last one that he saw, in the last one to kiss my son.
How well did this film, 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets, enable you to tell your story, the story of Jordan, as well as your story, your family's story, and how this affected the community in Jacksonville?
This film, 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets, we were so hopeful that it would do exactly what it has done. We took it and premiered it at Sundance Film Festival last year, 2015. And it touched the hearts and souls of people all across the country, you know. And what we want is for some of these families that do not get justice, the Trayvon Martin family, the Oscar Grant family, Eric Garner's family, all these other families that are out there, John Crawford's family, they don't, you know, get an indictment, they don't get justice, they don't get to go to court to see the killers of their child. And we want them to see that there's hope, that if you keep on fighting hard, it took us almost 2 years, keep fighting hard, maybe you will get justice, so don't stop fighting. So we wanted to see a story where someone did get justice, a family did get justice in the court system. And you don't get full justice until everybody that's been hurt and harmed get justice. So we're still fighting for the other families also.
And this case involving Michael Dunn, who essentially made up a story about seeing a weapon that did not exist, that the police never found. Did it appear to you that he might get away with that story? It ended up, the case ended up turning on the testimony of his fiance. And I can let you explain that. But was there a time when you thought, you know, he's lying and he's going to get away with it?
Yeah, because it's the old, let's put enough out there where we can get reasonable doubt, you know, and that's what the murderers tried to do in this case, is that initially he said there was a shotgun in the car. Now, his first attorney, which a lot of people don't know, he had an attorney before his current attorney.
And we don't see him in the video. Film.
Yeah. Right. And, well, it was a she, his original attorney. He told her that there was a shotgun. And so she ran to the press and immediately told the press that there was a shotgun. He didn't want that to get out to the press. So she opened her big mouth, basically, and she got fired the next day, you know. But he was stuck with that story with the shotgun because it's so hard to hide a shotgun. Had he said, like, a handgun, maybe they would still be looking for a handgun or something like that. But you know how big a mm-hmm. shotgun is, you know. So his new attorney was trying to downplay the shotgun theory, but the press kept saying shotgun, so they had to stick with that story. And then they try to, you know, create reasonable doubt by saying, well, the kids left the parking area. Well, they didn't go far. They only went a few hundred yards. And so they were in plain sight of different people that were at the gas station. And the kids never had a shotgun. Jordan has never handled a gun in his life. You know, I don't have any guns. You know, his mother doesn't have any guns. So he wouldn't know anything about a gun. Kids don't run around with full-blown shotguns and SUVs. They just don't do that. So his story was that his fiance decided to preserve herself because she had already had, you know, depositions saying that there was no gun. And so she was not going to lie for him on the stand. And basically, when you say that you got in your car after the shooting and didn't tell her that there was a gun, then you get to the hotel and you never say those kids had a gun. Then you drive the next day 2.5 hours to go home. And in that all that time you're driving, you never mention a weapon that these kids mm-hmm. have. How can all of a sudden during trial you mention a weapon? So I think the jury knew exactly where the lie was.
How well do you feel that the film depicts what happened to your son, as well as discuss the role bias and stereotypes play in society?
I think it does a good job discussing that because Michael Dunn, he did not want an interview for the film, so that's why we had to use coverage from
the trial,
and we also had to use his voice, you know, what he was saying on the phone to his loved ones. And Michael Dunn, see, he saw what happened in the George Zimmerman trial. You know, he knew that if he wanted to use his gun, that if he used Stand Your Ground, that he would get away. You know?
And the Zimmerman trial came before this.
That's correct. Yeah. You know, Zimmerman had already shot at Trayvon Martin, and basically it took them 41 days to arrest him. You know, and so this happened in Florida. This didn't happen far away from where Michael Dunn lived, you see. So Michael Dunn already had it in his mind. And then when they interviewed Michael Dunn, he's like, am I getting arrested? He could not believe he was getting arrested. Even though you shoot 10 bullets into a car full of kids and you don't dial 911 and you hear that you murdered a kid and you jump in your car and drive home without, again, dialing 911, he thought it's okay because he did not value Jordan's life. And that's what the point is of this whole thing, is that we have to start valuing each other's lives no matter what the nationality. And that's what he didn't do.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Ron Davis, who is the father of Jordan Davis, a black teenager fatally gunned down at a Florida gas station by a white man, 47-year-old Michael Dunn, in 2012. The story of that incident and the trial that followed, including Mr. Dunn's eventual conviction on a first-degree murder charge, is chronicled in a new documentary, 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets. It's being screened at the CMU McConomy Auditorium tonight, part of a preview of the CMU Film Festival. You can join our conversation with Ron Davis, who's with us here in studio, at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Again, the number 412-246-2002. We'd like to hear from you and perhaps get a discussion going about the Stand Your Ground law, which was at the heart of the defense in the case involving Michael Dunn. And we have a similar law, as you probably are aware, here in Pennsylvania, the Castle Doctrine, which 3 years ago was expanded to include the Stand Your Ground aspect of the law, similar to what they have in Florida. So your thoughts about that, 412-246-2002, the number to call. And Ron Davis, I would ask you what your feelings are about Florida's Stand Your Ground law, which we, as I just explained, also have essentially here in Pennsylvania.
We actually, me and Jordan's mother actually spoke in Tallahassee at the State House of Florida We were trying to repeal Stand Your Ground, and they denied it. They brought in the big guns. The actual woman that was the first female president of the NRA showed up, Marion Hammer, and also the person that wrote Stand Your Ground for the state of Florida, Mr. Baxley. And so they actually showed up because they were afraid that we were going to prevail. And so it was voted down because what the state of Florida did was they connected the Stand Your Ground law with the Castle Doctrine, which is your home is your castle. And no one wants to repeal the Castle Doctrine. So in order to repeal Stand Your Ground in Florida, you have to repeal the Castle Doctrine. So the best that we can do now is try to amend Stand Your Ground. And so that's what we're working on now. They, the NRA actually just recently tried to expand Stand Your Ground. Because currently under the Stand Your Ground law, the defense attorney would have to bring his client before a judge. And he'd have to show his all his evidence as he would in a trial. Well, they thought that that was something that a person that used that gun shouldn't have to endure. They shouldn't have to show all their evidence. So now what they're trying to do is put it on the prosecutor to show their evidence against the client using Stand Your Ground. So they're trying to, you know, double down on that. And also what they want to do is use Stand Your Ground where everyone shows that you must think of the shooter. What was in the mind of the shooter? Did the shooter have those five words, I feared for my life? That's what they always say. If you notice the policemen and citizens, when they shoot their gun, they tell them, always say, I feared for my life, because that has a possibility of getting you off, because there's all reasons why we fear. But if I feared for my life because of somebody's color of their skin, or because they were walking in an area that was dark, or they were wearing a hoodie, that doesn't give me the right to shoot somebody down and get off by saying, well, I had this fear, so that's why I shot somebody. And so we want to, at least in the state of Florida, we want to not repeal it, but at least amend Stand Your Ground and change these laws.
Did you ever at any point believe that Michael Dunn had feared for his life?
Not at all. First of all, Michael Dunn initially contacted the kids. The kids were already in the parking lot playing their music loud. He parked next to them, parked very close to them, and then he rolled down his window and contacted the kids. So he rolled his window back up, and he heard the music come back up. Now, any normal human being, an adult, would say, okay, they're not listening to me. I'm only going to be in this gas station another 2 minutes, and I'm out of here. That's what a normal person would do. But what he does is he rolled his window down again and started hollering at the kids, and then my son started hollering back at him. Again, those kids never got out the car to touch his car, to touch and touch a hair on his head. My son never got out the car to injure Michael Dunn. But he decided that, just like he said, you're not going to talk to me that way. He thought that he can just control these kids. And because he had that gun in his glove compartment, that gave him this incredible, you know, thought that I can rule the world. And understand your ground, I'll probably get away with it. So he thought that he would just grab his gun, and it was premeditated. You know, he took his gun out, took it out of the holster, turned around, aimed, and started shooting at the car. Could have killed every kid in there. And I was so thankful to God that the other three kids didn't get a scratch, because one almost got hit in the head. It lodged in the visor. The other one had metal in the door, so when the bullets hit his door, it didn't go through the metal. Unfortunately, in Jordan's door in the back, there's plastic, and the bullets came through, and that's how come Jordan was hit. And so this man, not only that, he had no value of life, because those bullets could have hit that gas station pump and blew up the entire gas station. He never thought about the other people that were in the gas station. He just kept firing. And on trial, which you don't see in the film, they asked Michael Dunn, they said, well, why did you stop shooting? He said, because the car got out of range. Had the car still been in range, I would have continued to shoot. That's what he said in court under oath.
What do you think needs to change with regard to gun laws and things like Stand Your Ground?
I think Stand Your Ground, number one, it should be decided by a jury rather than one judge. That judge could be biased. You know, we all have biases based on the fact that they had one case in Florida where this very old man, he actually walked with a cane, and he apparently didn't know where he was going, and he cut this guy off. The guy chased this old man in the car, pulled around, cut the old man off, jumped out of his car and started screaming at the old man and banging on the old man's window. The old man pulled out a gun and shot the person, who was a younger person, and killed him. The old man claimed Stand Your Ground because he indeed feared for his life, but he didn't get Stand Your Ground. You know why? Because the younger guy that was banging on his window worked for the Customs and Border Patrol. And see, when the judge sees that you work for an authority, whether it be the police department or FBI or Border Patrol, they tend to not give you stand your ground because of the person you kill. So it looks like the station in your life, who you are, whether they permit stand your ground or not. And also it has a racial bias to it. It has been proven by the Tampa Bay Times that stand your ground, ordinarily, if a black person shoots a white person, you don't get stand your ground. Many times that if a white person shoots a black person, they will get stand your ground. So we know that it has a racial bias, so it shouldn't be used. Also, it wants the jury to determine whether stand your ground exists by looking at the shooter. We can't tell what's in the mind of the shooter. We can't do it that way. And the third thing is this. Under stand your ground, they consider that if you're in the movie theater and you and your family come out the theater and two people are engaged in an argument, and they're both standing their ground, and they come out and they pull weapons and shoot at each other. Do you know if the bullets miss and hit your family member and kills one of your family members, maybe kills your kid, that that's considered collateral damage? That under stand your ground law, if that person gets stand your ground, you have no authority in court. You cannot sue in a criminal court or in a civil court under stand your ground laws. You're just collateral damage.
The murder of your son happened on Black Friday, and now you are encouraging black community members to boycott Black Friday. Explain why you're doing this.
I'm not just encouraging black community members. I'm encouraging all community members, white, black, Asian, Indian, whatever. I think all of us, because Black Friday is just a way for this country to get money. It's all about money. And what we should look at Black Friday is something that was created by the government, by the stores, by the economics of this world. And what we want to do is have people stay with their family, stay home on Black Friday, cook dinner with their families, not spend money, show your economic strength. See, this country, they believe that no matter what holiday they come up with, we're going to go out and spend our money. Right now, we have no economic freedom. So there's a lot of people in this country that decide that if we show economic freedom and all of a sudden there's a dip on Black Friday of 10% or 15%, then all of a sudden that shows that there is economic freedom and that you're not going to take everything that goes on here in the political system.
What has been the reaction to the film?
It has been great, greatly received in Sundance. We won an award for social impact at Sundance. We've also shown Sundance at the White House. The film at the White House. This film has gone to several countries in Europe. It went to England. We went over there and we premiered it at Piccadilly. Three other theaters showed the film and they held it over. So we've gotten great response from the public, great response from the reviewers, Hollywood Reporter and all the other, major outlets. And so we're very proud of this film. We think Mark Silver did an excellent job, on this film. He doesn't understand the gun culture in America because he lives in England. And whenever you go to another country that doesn't allow guns in their country, like you go to Japan and you don't allow handguns in Japan, look at the crime rate, how small it is. In England, you don't have the same crime rate that we do. We don't have the same murders. And so I think the lawmakers in America, they know that if we didn't have guns in this country, it'd be a great country again. But, they can't look past that the campaign contributors are the gun manufacturers through the NRA, and they're not going to buck the system, and they're going to keep taking those campaign contributions.
The film, again, is called 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets, a documentary that is screening tonight at 6 o'clock at CMU's McConomy Auditorium. It tells the story of 17-year-old Jordan Davis, who was fatally gunned down at a Florida gas station by a 47-year-old white man back in 2012. My guest has been the father of Jordan Davis, Ron Davis. Mr. Davis, thank you so much for joining us. And I should mention again that you will be appearing at the screening tonight at CMU. Thank you for appearing with us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Come on out tonight and see us. And it's a great film, and I can't wait for the Q&A after the film.
Coming up, we'll meet the director of a narrative feature film called Blood First. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.